Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher at the Security Ledger. We read a lot about so-called dark markets, the secretive and mostly hidden bazaars where cyber criminals trade their wares, plot campaigns, and obtain the tools and talent necessary to carry them out. In this week's Security Ledger podcast, we're going to do a deep dive on how these marketplaces operate with Luca Alodi, a researcher at the University of Eindhoven in the Netherlands who's found that dark markets are often more efficient than their above-board counterparts. Also this week, Jordan Wright of the firm Duo Security does a deep dive with us on research his company did on the underground market for phishing toolkits, which let cyber criminals build sophisticated phishing campaigns with just a modicum of skill and talent. And in our final segment, there's been a lot of news about the Russian-backed hacking group known as Fancy Bear. In this week's podcast, we talk with a researcher at the firm Threat Connect, which has looked into Fancy Bear attacks on citizen journalism site Bellingcat.com, a vocal critic of the Russian government. But first, there's a common saying that there is no honor among thieves, but researcher Luca Alodi of the University of Eindhoven begs to differ. His research into the workings of underground dark markets has found that the most successful and well-trafficked of these are characterized by rigid and strictly enforced codes of conduct that ensure fair and prompt payment for goods and services. In fact, dark markets appear to do a better job understanding what he calls the economics of attack acquisition and deployment than do their above-board competitors like vendor-sponsored bug bounty programs. I started by asking Luca to explain the economics of attack acquisition and deployment and what he means by that complex term.
So I'm Luca Alodi. I am an assistant professor at the University of Technology of Eindhoven in the Netherlands. My research that has, at the end of the day, mostly to do with the quantification of cyber risk, for which I see this economic production of new attacks as one very important block that needs to be defined to get there.
So in this paper that you presented, your focus was on what you call the economics of attack acquisition and deployment. Could you kind of say a little bit more about what you're referring to there, what that means?
There are different types of attackers, right? There are the attackers that engineer their own attacks because they want one specific system or one specific class of systems. These are very skillful, but they are also very few. And they, at the end of the day, they don't deliver many attacks at scale, because here we're always talking about attacks at scale. And then there is the other part that is responsible reportedly for the vast majority of attacks in the wild, that is composed by attackers who are not technically incredibly skilled. They're proficient, savvy, I think it's a word. But then that they acquire their attacks from an economy, from an underground economy, really, that generates these attacks. As such, this economy operates essentially in the underground. There are several different parts of communities. There are English-speaking, Chinese-speaking, and Russian-speaking, which is the community I focus on this work. And in these communities, these attackers essentially look and offer new attack technology, new vulnerability exploits, new pieces of malware, or mechanisms to deliver the actual attacks to the final systems that then are infected. And they trade this among themselves with fairly robust contractual forms and very rigorous regulation of the market, which actually makes the economy possible in the first place, and that essentially fosters the generation of new attacks and, if you want, incentivizes the update of attack portfolios and the creation of a new exploit kit when an old one dies, or the substitution at scale of a vulnerability with another, and so forth.
So one of the interesting things is that, you know, in recent years, we've seen the emergence of a above board or legitimate market for software vulnerabilities, which is via bug bounty programs and things like that. So there's now, I guess, a way to compare both black market and white market openings or offerings for particular types of products like vulnerabilities. And you took a look at that in your research as well. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I am not in the position really to make conclusive remarks on this, but certainly looking at the prices, the dynamics of trade, of exploits in the underground, can tell us something on how to cleverly design the legal markets, the bug bounties that we want to incentivize. Because at the end of the day, that equilibrium between the darker and grayish part of the markets and the legitimate market is what we want to control in order to attract talent away, right, from the black markets, essentially. And what I observe is that, so first of all, to be entirely straightforward, let's say, what I observe in the market I have been studying is a trade of exploit, whereas bug bounty programs, they're not really trade of exploit, but mostly trade of vulnerabilities with proof of concept exploits, right? So that it's not very straightforward to compare, for example, the monetary compensation that you get in the two markets. Then for sure, they're part of the same ecosystem, right? So having an idea of how many dollars you get per trade in the Russian markets for a very good remote code execution exploit for Microsoft Edge or Internet Explorer, having a good grasp of that number can also help you understand what are the sort of economic incentives in participating in that economy. And then one can actually think of clever policies, both economic policies and also legal and managerial policies to encourage the participation of the people that are now in the underground to actually participate in the legal part of the market.
Okay, so explain for us what you think would be some intelligent ways to, as you said, siphon some of the talent away from black market, underground cyber criminal marketplaces to above ground non-criminal marketplaces. Would it be to shift from paying for vulnerabilities to actually paying for exploits so that you could more closely mirror or replicate what's happening in the underground markets?
No, I think that the more important aspect, at least in my intuition, and it's uncertainty that drives a lot of these sort of things. Currently in the legal market, you are never really sure of how much money you're going to get for how much effort. That's unfortunately, it's a bit of a fact of life, right? Because if you decide to look for vulnerabilities for a living, you may find some or you may find none. It's a bit like going in Klondike to look for gold, right? If you're lucky, you find the big chunk of gold and you're going to make a lot of money, or you find a very good vulnerability and you get your 15 or 20,000 from Microsoft. But then, even then, it's not really sure that a very good vulnerability corresponds to a very good monetary compensation. For example, because if the report of the vulnerability is not up to standard, or there is some uncertainty with respect to how the vulnerability is defined, or how to fix it, or the POC does not always work, you may get much less than the upper bound, up to 10% of the original thing. So from 15,000, you get 1,500, which is a significant uncertainty for whomever needs to do this for a living. The markets that I observe are very good at managing this uncertainty on the side of who sells the exploits. Because one of the major problems of these markets is, of course, that these are criminals that trade anonymously with other criminals, right? So in theory, nothing stops them from ripping each other off all the time. It's not like I try to buy an exploit in the underground and then I go to the FBI and say, I've been ripped off, I want my money back. It's not going to happen, right? So it's very difficult to enforce this sort of trade regulation that makes the market eventually work. But this market is very good at doing this, so that the seller that puts his exploit in the market is sure that if that thing actually works, then customers will arrive and the sales will all go towards a good end. So the uncertainty around the amount of money that you get per finding, per exploit, if you want, is fixed. Whereas in the legal market, there is substantial more uncertainty, both on the sort of economic income, economic return that you get by selling the vulnerability to the vendor, And also to the fact that some vendors, and that's also related to another talk that was in the same session as mine, there is also some associated legal risk, because some companies, some vendors are still not particularly happy in receiving vulnerability information and the like. So I think that the first thing that needs to be addressed is this sort of uncertainty around the reward that if can be lowered to by a significant amount, then I think will be effective in attracting good people that would do this for a living and actually doing it, as opposed to, you know, jumping a little bit from one side to the other, maybe, or, you know, doing it only part-time and finding fewer vulnerabilities, maybe.
Obviously, in the cyber criminal market, there's no guarantee that people are going to buy your working exploit. Although what you're saying is, if it's a good working exploit and you know that, you know it's going to sell. And that's sort of where you get your guarantee from of, you know, I know that people will want a working exploit for whatever the platform is, right?
I'm not saying that if you have a good exploit, you put it in the market, you're certain that people will come up. But I've seen that these exploits are updated by the vendors at very steady and slow cycles, if you want. But what it really meant is that once trade is initiated, so when a potential buyer comes over and says, I am interested, the seller knows exactly what is the value of that sell, and he knows exactly that there are mechanisms in the market that make sure that if the seller buys, he gets the full amount of the money, and that we will not suffer, for example, from unfair punishments from the community and so forth because he misbehaves.
There are all these kind of legal hooks and ties in the above ground marketplace that are basically instituted by the vendors themselves that make it unclear what the eventual payday will be, if there will be any.
In the underground, this doesn't seem to be the case. It's much more determining.
I mean, we are dealing with, you know, thieves, and as the saying goes, there is no honor among thieves. But you say that within these marketplaces, actually, there is a fair amount of regulation that, in fact, there has to be for these markets to flourish. Who are the enforcers, and what form does enforcement take to make sure that everyone abides by the rules of the market?
Yeah, no, this is one of the aspects that I love the most about this place. It's really, I've had a thorough look at several of these markets, and most of them, let me tell you, are just rubbish. They're terrible. I mean, it's all full of rules and promises that are never maintained. In this one market, that seems to operate very well. There are a set of rules, and the enforcers of these rules are typically the administrators or the moderators. And what happens is that they have what they call trials. It's called trials, where essentially the defenders or people, essentially the field that have been ripped off, this can be either buyers or sellers, irrespective, they can go over and claim that they have been ripped off for a certain amount of money. And the more surprising thing is that these sort of trials actually do happen as trials. They have witnesses. They essentially provide evidence, hard evidence, with screenshots of Bitcoin transactions, with reports of logs, and with specific applications that guarantee that the screenshots are not tampered with, to show that that's actual evidence of, for example, a conversation that happened privately, but at the end of the day constitutes a contract between the buyer and the seller. And the more perhaps surprising aspect of all of this is that the authority of the administrators is incredibly strong, is very feared, to the point that I see all sorts of things happening. I see people that are found to be guilty be sentenced to give back all the money. And I've seen these people actually then reporting hard evidence from the side of who thinks has been offended, right? From the side of the accuser, that there is the Bitcoin transaction of the money back towards his own wallet for money like for amounts that are only $2,000, $3,000, $5,000. So we are talking about anonymous Russian criminals that operate in an anonymous environment, and by having the only fear of being punished by the community as opposed to by law enforcement or anything else, comply to the rules to the point of giving back thousands of dollars to the buyers. And this sort of certainty in the way that these trials are managed and they are conducted by the community really lowers also that uncertainty I was mentioning before. The perception is that it is a very, very fair system where everybody knows what are the rules, and the rules are very well enforced. And if you operate by the rules, you know that you're going to be fine. And that's a remarkable aspect. Even the very trivial things like to get to the market, there is a threshold of time. So sorry, to get to trial, there is a threshold of time. So the accuser comes over to the trial. He says, I have this person to report. Then the administrator say, you have total amount of hours to show yourself, you being the defender. If you don't, you punished, okay? And this amount of time also depends on, for example, how much money the accuser is claiming back. If that's a few hundred, maybe you're given a week. If it's a few thousand, then the thing is much more urgent and they want to hear from you in a couple of days. And these things, I see them enforced all the time. So even these very simple rules that at the end of the day, even if he shows up after a week, probably wouldn't change much in terms of how the market operates. But even these very small things are all very strictly enforced and respected by the members of the community, which I think is very remarkable.
I mean, are there analogs here to like narcotics? You know, there is the debate about, well, if you legalize narcotics, and, you know, in the United States, many states are beginning to legalize marijuana. You're taking the money out of the black market. You're bringing it into the above ground market. You're taking out criminals, or at least turning criminals into business people, legitimate businessmen and women. And you're kind of solving the underlying social problem. Is there any reason to think that there's an analog here in the, you know, cyber crime world?
Well, it's a very, very tricky question, right? It depends on really how you define a vulnerability and then exploit. And I think the current agreed upon definition in the Wassenaar Agreement is something that has a lot of in common, or a lot to share with weapons. In the sense that if you can weaponize a vulnerability by writing a working exploit, then that thing is seen as offensive technology, essentially.
Who are the buyers and sellers on these markets? Do we have any idea? And might some of them be doing double duty, both in the underground and then maybe in the above ground or white hat or gray hat markets?
What I can tell you is that I've never seen somebody, at least in the more technical part of the market where malware and exploits are, speaking a language other than Russian. So my first very rough rule of thumb guess is that the most of the technology would remain among the Russian-speaking community. Then, I mean, people are bilingual and Russians can live elsewhere. So I don't really know. Of course, these transactions are also anonymous and they all operate under nicknames and whatnot. What I do see is that in general, although even from the market regulation, speaking Russian is not obligatory to remain in the market, it seems to be strongly encouraged. Also, in terms of, well, the few times where I see somebody replying to an offer in Russian but replying in English, it does not seem that the interaction goes quite in the same direction. It looks like there is a little bit of
a bias.
Yes, exactly.
And you said that there's a really clear line or correlation between the amount of market activity or interest in a particular exploit and the likelihood that it will then be deployed kind of in the wild or used in attacks. I guess that makes sense intuitively, but explain how that works.
Well, so essentially the intuition is that if these markets are an important aspect of the overall attack scenario at scale, so speaking about, you know, normal commodity system, if you wish, that are, you know, normal computer systems that then receive malware and are infected and bank accounts are stolen and whatnot, then what we should expect that whatever market activity happens around the technology that ultimately delivers this attack, there should be a correlation between that activity and the actual, if you want, probability or odds, really, of the attack being materializing in the real world. So what I did is that essentially I tested these more formally by looking at the actual correlation between market activities and prices and vulnerability characteristics against real data of which exploits are actually found there. And they find a very strong correlation. It also goes in an intuitive direction, right? Essentially, as a rule of thumb, what I find is that every time the market activity around one exploit doubles, so does the odds of finding something in the wild. Whereas wherever the price doubles, the relation is that the odds of an exploit in the wild halve. And the same goes more or less with the severity. So this also allows us to have actual numbers, right? So if we can measure the vulnerabilities and we can measure somehow the markets, then we can also make a prospect of how the change in risk will look like. For example, if we know that a vulnerability does not appear in the market, but then a certain day it arrives, and that vulnerability affects a certain type of software and is traded for a certain amount of money, then we can have good projection of how we would expect the risk carried by that vulnerability evolve as time passes and new trades arrive and so on.
Fascinating. And is there a big lag between the market activity and the in the wild activity, or is it more or less instantaneous? People are buying these and turning around and using them right away?
This is something I cannot answer because my data on the attacks that are in the wild are one or zero, right?
If there is one big scale
or there is none.
Right.
But what I do see is that if we move a step backwards and instead of looking at the actual attacks in the wild, we look at disclosure of vulnerabilities, the lag between when a vulnerability becomes published, let's say, and when an exploit is introduced in the market is quite large. We're speaking about several months, even for the faster exploit. Then, of course, there are exceptionally fast exploits that arrive a week after publication of the vulnerability. But then most exploits are very slow to arrive, meaning also that one sense that probably the engineering aspects of exploits is demanding in terms of time and effort. And on the other side, which is even more interesting to me, is that probably attackers just don't care about every single vulnerability because the time of renewal of exploits for specific software platforms is also very large, meaning that attackers exploit one vulnerability at scale, of course, in this market for a specific software platform every X months, 6 to 7 months. And in those 6 months, tens of other vulnerabilities for the very same platform have been released, but the attackers just decided to ignore them. So this is also something we should think about when we actually make prospects of vulnerability risk, for example.
Yeah, we see that all the time where there might be news stories about a big new security hole and everyone's like, oh my gosh, you know, the attacks are going to come, but you don't actually typically see attacks for quite a while, sometimes never. And I guess the argument is there's no market need for that new tool because they've got a tool that's working perfectly fine.
Yeah, I would totally agree.
If you were to say one thing that you could take away from this research or lesson learned for the security community or the vendor community, what would it be, Luca?
It would be to stop caring about every single vulnerability and start caring more about what makes sense for the attackers to deliver at the end of the day, from an economic and engineering perspective as well. So that computer science and computer security is not only about writing code and writing exploits, but it's also about the process that generates attacks. And we still know very little about that.
And I guess you would say go down to the bazaar, go down to the market and look at what's going on there. That'll tell you a lot about what you need to worry about.
Yeah, and it's also a lot of fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Luca Lodi, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to the Security Ledger podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure. Very interesting as well.
And next, phishing attacks are the foot in the door for most sophisticated hacks these days. But where do they come from? Duo Security, a company that offers strong authentication tools, has researched the universe of phishing kits, collections, and files of scripts that make it easy for just about anyone to set up a sophisticated phishing scam. Jordan Wright of Duo joined us on the Security Ledger podcast. He said that one of the biggest findings of their research was how much sharing of tools and assets is happening in the cyber underground between different and, in theory, competing cyber criminal groups.
My name is Jordan Wright, and I'm a senior R&D engineer for Duo Security. Phishing is clearly a large problem. You know, we're seeing anywhere up to 24% of recipients are clicking the links, and 13% of recipients are actually entering their credentials, which shows that it's worth looking at phishing a little bit deeper. One of our core technologies is multi-factor authentication. It was kind of our first flagship product. That's what makes phishing appealing to us, is that the kits that we study in this research paper, they're credential stealers. Their goal is to get as many usernames and passwords as possible so that they can either be sold or used to commit further fraud. Some of the research that we've seen before along these same lines is looking at maybe one or two phishing kits that people come across when studying something else related to phishing. But we decided maybe it would be better if we took a deeper dive and looked at this ecosystem as a whole, you know, trying to figure out what can we tell about this phishing economy? You know, how are these kits moving around? Who are the actors behind it? How are they launching these campaigns? You know, what are some of the tools and tactics that they're using, and give people that glimpse and that view into how all of this works so that they can better protect themselves?
And when we're talking about phishing toolkits, what are in these toolkits? I mean, what are the various tools in the tool belt, as it were?
It all falls back on phishing being a business. And like any business person, attackers are looking to increase their return on investment. Their goal is to make their operations as efficient as possible. They've decided not to reinvent the wheel for every new phishing campaign. They look at it and say, why would I recreate my phishing sites every time, whenever what I could do is package everything that I need to run a phishing campaign into a single zip file that I can use on any number of different hosts that I want to host my phishing site. And so the way it typically works is they'll figure out what service provider they want to spoof, whether that's Facebook, Gmail, Office 365, you name it. Any service provider is fair game. And then they'll clone that login page. And they'll also clone a copy of any assets needed for that login page. These are images, style sheets, JavaScript, all of the resources that you would need to make a convincing copy of that login page. And then what they'll do is they'll take the login form that's on that page, and then they'll change it to point to a script that they write. This script has one job, and it's really simple. It's to collect the credentials and then to email those credentials to the attacker. So they'll take this script, and they'll take all of these site resources. They'll zip them up into what we call the phishing kit, and then they'll go out and find a place to host this kit, to host their phishing site. A common tactic that we found in our paper is that they'll go find old WordPress instances, or WordPress instances that have out-of-date plugins, out-of-date themes, that have known vulnerabilities. They'll exploit these services, and then they can upload their phishing kit, and then they'll extract the files from it. Remember, it's just a zip file. And once they do that, they have a working phishing site. They can send out emails pointing to their new phishing site, they collect credentials, and then make off of those credentials. The trick is whenever they forget to remove that zip file. That's the backbone of this entire research, is that if they don't remember to remove that zip file, anyone can come along and download it. Once we download the zip file, we can look at everything that's in it. This includes that script and figuring out what information is being collected, where is it being sent, and we can piece these parts together and create a mapping of sorts to show, here's how all of this is working. Here's how attackers are moving around, using different kits, sharing information with one another, as well as a couple other interesting findings that we can talk about here in just a little bit.
And one of the things you found is that there does seem to be sharing going on between some of these kit authors and groups. So it does seem like there is a organized effort on the cyber underground to further these kits and these attacks, even if that means, you know, sharing some of their proprietary information.
That's right. We do see quite a bit of evidence that suggests that information of some sort is being shared amongst attackers, whether that's snippets in an htaccess file, or that the credential stealing script, you know, that's copied frequently, or it could just be assets, you know, the HTML and images used for a particular service provider, so that attackers don't have to reinvent that wheel. One of the things that's important to cover is we talked about phishing being a business and trying to increase that return on investment. And part of that is keeping your phishing site up and available as long as possible. Because while my phishing site is available, I can continue collecting credentials. And so this is where those htaccess files come into play. These files are used in conjunction with the Apache web server, where they tell the web server, here's what connections to allow or deny based on different attributes. So I can say I want to deny connections that are coming from an IP address known to belong to a security company, or I want to block connections from a user agent known to belong to a crawler from this particular security company. Attackers know that threat intelligence companies and security companies are always looking to shut down their sites as quickly as possible. So they put in measures just like these to try to prevent that from happening.
And you saw as well, or you observed just a lot of reuse of these kits between different phishing sites. So these, you might have the same kit being used to host or enable multiple different phishing sites. Is that right?
That's right. So in our month-long study, we found that a majority of kits are only seen one time, but 27% of our kits that we came across were in fact seen on more than one host, indicating some level of reuse. So it's important to note that whenever we say unique kits, we're actually taking a hash of the phishing kit, which means that if anything changes, even if they change one character in one file, that's going to give us a different hash. And so these are exactly the same kits used across multiple sites, where we even found some instances, I think two in particular, that were found on more than 30 different unique websites, indicating very active attackers. You know, we got to keep in mind, this research was only done over a month-long period, so having more than 30 different campaigns going indicates very active attackers who are running multiple different campaigns, all with the same exact phishing kit.
So the inference there would be this is one cybercriminal group operating 30 simultaneous phishing campaigns using the same kit.
That's right.
Yeah. What did you learn, or what do we know about this underground economy of people involved in phishing scams? Phishing is kind of the foot in the door for so many different things, for data breach and other types of compromises, identity theft, and so on. What do we know about the people who are furthering these attacks and where this fits in overall to the sort of cyber criminal economy?
So I think the phishing economy fits in really well with the rest of what we would consider to be the cybercrime economy, which is anytime there's a service to be offered or money to be made, there's someone lining up ready to provide that service, and phishing is no different. We have seen reports, not for any kits specific to our research, but we have come across reports in the past that have come across forums and shops designed to sell these phishing kits. And they're very cheap because they're extremely easy to make. They're sold from anywhere from $2 to $10, I think, from a report from Symantec. And so one thing that's interesting about this economy is that some attackers will use this as an opportunity to maybe get an advantage over other attackers. And this is what we saw in our research. We found that due to this trading, you know, they're not always sold. Sometimes phishing kits are traded. They're given away freely to other attackers. But sometimes in the process of this, some more enterprising attackers will add a backdoor to the phishing kit, which whenever they're given to someone else and then they're used, will give anyone access to the host without having to do any of the work. And that's what we saw was really prolific and the phishing kits that we studied, appearing more than 200 times. You know, we expected maybe one or two different backdoors, but the specific backdoor that we cover in our report was seen all over the place, indicating that this kind of backdoor and this kind of giving away a phishing kit for free while trying to still get something out of it is really prolific in this particular economy.
Now, would that mean that the actor who put in the backdoor is looking to use those assets for, let's say, you know, to establish a botnet, or is it more that they might be interested in whatever is, you know, running on the server where their phishing kit is running?
It could be both. You know, it could be any number of reasons, because the backdoor that we're seeing isn't just them collecting credentials. It's full access to the host where, you know, anyone who knows what parameter to send in the URL can run any system command they want, completely compromising the host. So it's possible that they could be looking to maybe run their own phishing campaigns or take over hosts after they're done being used. Any number of reasons could be valid for why they may backdoor those phishing kits.
I looked at this graphic where you've got this one email, wires@googledocs.org, kind of at the center of this, looks like an exploding galaxy of links. What's up with that email address? And did we go any way towards identifying individuals or groups who are driving some of this activity?
Right. So this particular email address was really interesting. And it kind of falls back on the information that we get whenever we come across a phishing kit. You'll remember that the way that the phishing site works is that it has that script that collects credentials and emails it off to the attacker.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that script will usually contain two email addresses, not just one. The first email address is what you would expect. It's the email address of the person collecting the credentials. But the second email address is almost used as a signing card, where attackers who create the phishing kits and then distribute them out to other attackers will include an alias or an email address in the from header that's used in that email that contains the credentials. So the attacker will receive an email from, you know, the person who created the phishing kit's email address, and that's the email address that you see in that graph that you're referring to. Is that this particular email address was a great example of how we can use the knowledge we get from phishing kits to map out this ecosystem and map out here are the actors using or creating different phishing kits, or at least different pieces of phishing kits. This particular email address was seen over 115 times in different unique phishing kits on all sorts of different sites, showing just how widely this information is shared and used by different attackers.
Do we believe that that is one individual or a group or a brand? What is it?
It's hard to say for sure, but one thing we do know is that this is an alias used by the person who created this initial script, credential collecting script that was then sent out to who knows where. You know, maybe it was posted on a forum. You know, they may have even made full phishing kits. Or they may have just given out the credential stealing script and said, here, you need to add this to your own phishing kits and use it. But they are the origin, if you will. It's unknown if that's a group or a single individual. Chances are that email address probably isn't even a real email address. It's probably just an alias used. Mm-hmm. Or it may have been active at one time. But it is kind of an indicator to kind of map out this level of information sharing.
Really fascinating. So, I mean, the big question, obviously, is now that we know all this, now that you have these insights, does it change in any way how you defend against phishing attacks?
So I think it just falls back to this idea of encouraging a defense-in-depth approach whenever we go against phishing. You know, the thing that's really interesting about looking at phishing as a problem is that it really does require protection at every layer of the stack. And so one thing that we've done with this research is that we're releasing all of the code that we wrote to find, collect, and analyze these phishing kits for free. We're open sourcing it and we're putting it on GitHub so organizations can take this code and adapt it to their own use cases. This is beneficial because if I'm a security admin at an organization and I have a phishing attack that's being launched against my user base, my goal is to find out as much as I can about what's going on so that I can do incident response more effectively. And that's what this code will let you do. If I can find the phishing kit and I can analyze it, I can really quickly see here's what information they're collecting, here's where it's going. And I can even take that a step further and I can say, I can reach out to wherever or whoever is hosting that email address for the attacker and let them know, this email address was used in a fraudulent campaign. You may want to shut down this email address so that it can't be used to collect credentials in the future. And so we can start to push back on this level of attacks that we see and try to respond to it in a more effective way, both at the mail provider level, you know, sending these email addresses to them and letting them shut them down, but also at an organization level, just having more information that can be used when doing incident response.
Jordan Wright is a research and development engineer at Duo Security. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast.
Great. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.
And in our final segment, the Associated Press broke a big story last week detailing the extent of attacks by Russian advanced threat group Fancy Bear against individuals and groups who are known to be critical of the Russian government and the regime of Vladimir Putin. Rob Simmons of the firm Threat Connect came in to talk to us about his company's research into the attacks on one of those targets, the citizen journalism site Bellingcat.com, which has exposed links between the Russian military and the downing of a Malaysian Airlines passenger jet over the Ukraine in 2014.
My name is Rob Simmons. I work for Threat Connect, and I am the Director of Research Innovation, and I am one of the two directors that runs the research team here at Threat Connect. Threat Connect is a threat intelligence platform. We are an aggregator of threat intelligence from, you know, your network, from open source feeds, from paid feeds, and then the platform allows you to analyze and enrich that data and then push the data out to defensive devices so that you can protect yourself from various attacks.
You wrote about this stash or tranche of materials, spear phishing emails that you believe is linked to this Russian APT group known as Fancy Bear. Tell us a little bit about this group of emails and how you obtained them.
Sure. So the Bellingcat journalists contacted us with what they believed was a very suspicious attack, a set of spearfish that began on October 16th. So around October 16th, they began receiving these emails. And, you know, shortly after that, they contacted us with a few examples of them so that we were able to analyze it. So quickly after that, we looked at the emails themselves, also the URLs that were contained in the emails. So the URLs that were contained in the emails were a kind of a new technique that we hadn't seen before. But they did lead the visitor or the victim to a final landing page, which was very similar to some of the attacks that have been perpetrated against Bellingcat in the past and against many other targets of the Fancy Bear threat actor group.
And we should probably talk about Bellingcat. It's a really great website, kind of citizens-based investigative reporting website, I guess is the best way to describe it. It's Bellingcat, Bellingcat.com. One of the things that they've dug deep on is the downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 14 back in 2014, I believe, over Ukraine, the accidental downing of that passenger jet. And they've done a lot of open source research that have connected the dots back to particular units of the Russian military who were operating in Ukraine at that time. So that would apparently make them a target. What were some of the techniques or phishing techniques that were being deployed against this website and the folks who write for it?
The technique that was used in the email itself. So just to cover some of the basics of spear phishing and phishing emails. The email has to be structured in a way that looks like something legitimate. And in the case here, there were two general variations of the email, and they both had, you know, pretty much a similar theme. So one purported to be coming from Google, and it was, you know, someone has your password or please change your password, these types of where you have lost control of your account or someone else has accessed your account. So it's a link that you follow, and then you type in your new password, or you type in your old password and your new password. Another variant that they were sending out with this particular campaign was someone has invited you to edit a folder on Dropbox. So you go to the folder, and then you would enter in your credentials, and be, you know, if it was legitimate, you'd be passed to a folder of files on Dropbox. But in this case, you have just surrendered your credentials over to the adversary.
And we're saying, oh, this is Fancy Bear. This is the Russian government, Russian-affiliated APT group. How do we know that? What are the telltale signs, or what are the dotted or solid line connections back to the Russian government or groups affiliated with the Russian military?
There is a model that our team uses called the Diamond Model for Intrusion Analysis. And the Diamond Model has, at the top of the diamond is the adversary. The bottom of the diamond is the victim. And then on the left and right corners of the diamond, one of them is called the capabilities. So in more common language, this would be the attack patterns or the types of malware or the emails that are sent out to attack the victim by the adversary. And then the other corner of the diamond is known as the infrastructure. And so infrastructure are IP addresses or email addresses or URLs that are used to send or transmit the attack, and then to bring any of the data that they have collected back out of the attack and give that to the adversary. In this particular attack, what we found were obviously we've got overlap with a previous victim. So the victim of the Bellingcat journalist, they have been attacked by this adversary in the past, and those past attacks have been attributed to Fancy Bear. So that's one connection that we can make with previous attacks. Another, which is separate from any specific previous attack other than one, we were able to look at what's known as passive DNS information. So passive DNS is where a particular IP address has had a resolution to a host name, and that host name to IP address pair was collected from a passive DNS sensor out over on the internet, and it was collected at, over the past few years. So you could see at a particular time that a host name resolved to a particular IP address.
And that relationship existed relative to an attack in the past.
Correct. So relative to this particular attack that we're talking about today, all of those phishing emails through the different redirects and the URLs eventually landed the victim on one particular IP address. So looking at the passive DNS information for that IP address, we were able to find other host names that had the same pattern and also resolved back to that same IP address. So, for example, one of the host names that resolved to that IP address was google.com.accountpassword.ga. So this is one that was actually collected from one of the URLs used in the attack against Bellingcat. This resolved to the IP address 8255.12.231. And then we saw on that same IP address was another host name, and this one specifically was accounts.google.com.securitymail.gq.
So using those subdomains to make it look like this is an official Google domain when, of course, it isn't.
Yeah, so when you look at that URL, you may just be paying attention to the first part where accounts.google.com, and so that's where it gets tricky. But what we did was we took it a step further and looked at those other host names to see where have they resolved to in the past. And that's actually where we got some of the really interesting information here. So the host name, accounts.google.com.securitymail.gq, this one, the domain part, so the one that the adversary registered with the registrar, is securitymail.gq. We found that last year, this particular domain resolved to a IP address that was used by Fancy Bear for another host name. So this other host name was smtprelayhost.com. So SMTP relay host resolved to this previous IP address from December 2015 to December 2016. So it was there for a couple days under 1 year. And so during that year, the domain securitymail.gq also was resolving to that same IP address. And there is, you know, there can be a reason why these two host names would resolve to an IP address. It could be a parking page such as this, but this particular IP address is a broadband IP address that's on the Teladva network in Estonia. So it isn't a, you know, web hosting company. It's not like a web service where there's a possibility of there being two host names resolving to the same IP address, and there's sort of an explanation for why that would happen. So this is an IP address that would be one entity controls that IP address.
And one of the other things you noted was that there was a use of the Google Blogspot platform, which mm-hmm. is a blogging platform, to try and kind of whitewash some of these malicious phishing URLs as well, as part of the forwarding chain, I'm guessing?
Yes. So one of the things that every adversary has had to do recently, because spam filtering and security filtration on email and network has gotten, you know, better. And so they have to use more clever techniques to get their URLs and to get that malicious email past protections. And so they've begun using hosting systems that would be more likely to slip past and evade these security controls. So a URL that's hosted on Blogspot would be more likely to slip past a security control than a URL that's on, you know, some random registrar mm-hmm. pointing to a private server. So if the redirect was what they were hosting on Blogspot, and the redirect then took the victim to the final landing page on a server they control. So they kind of distanced themselves from the security system that was monitoring the emails coming in. So they would not necessarily have gotten past the security controls had they put that landing page URL in the email, but by using Blogspot as a redirection, they were able to slip the email past security controls.
So this is all relevant because really almost at the same time you posted your blog post, the Associated Press came out with a major story revealing that a trove of phishing emails and other supporting files also believed to belong to Fancy Bear had turned up online, fallen into the hands of a security company called SecureWorks. And AP had spent some time going over those. So they provided really a list of targets that this particular hacking group had been going after going back quite a while. And it was a pretty interesting list. Are there similarities between the Bellingcat operation and what we read about Fancy Bear's other phishing campaigns?
I would love to see, you know, firsthand some of the exemplars of the phishing emails that were referenced in that news article, but because I haven't seen the actual emails themselves, I can't draw any inferences to whether those are related or in any way related to what we're looking at now. So I wouldn't be able to make any comparisons or judgment till I see the emails themselves and I'm able to analyze it myself.
So you guys, see and analyze a lot of different phishing attacks. We talk about Fancy Bear as a advanced persistent threat group. Is there anything particularly advanced about at least the Bellingcat content and the phishing campaign that they launched, or is this pretty much run of the mill in terms of targeted phishing attacks?
So that's one of the problems that we have in general, you know, in information security, is that the standard, normal attacks like this are effective, and so the adversary has not needed to change the basic technique. You can see that they have begun to change some of the hosting methodologies for their infrastructure, because the hosting site that's used for this redirector, they're leveraging Blogspot, so they've had to kind of move their infrastructure into locations that are less likely to be detected. But the basic phishing attack itself, which is a an email sent to the target that tries to get their trust into and thinking that this thing is legitimate, and then the format of the final landing page where they enter their information needs to look like that, you know, system. So in this case, it did actually look like a legitimate Google password reset page. So those qualities of the attack haven't changed, and I don't think will change until that attack pattern becomes less effective.
Do we know if anyone within the Bellingcat organization fell for any of these phishing scams? And what can companies do to protect themselves against these types of attacks? We often hear, you know, multi-factor authentication will stop these attacks from being able to actually gain access to your account. Is it as simple as just using multi-factor?
I have not heard of this particular campaign being successful. But what I will say is that, like you mentioned, it's always good to have second factor authentication on your account, and especially using second factor authentication that is a true token-based second factor. And one that's really good is U2F, which is a standard developed by the FIDO group. And so U2F is a set of different tokens that you can go and buy. They're actually hardware tokens. And so using a second factor that doesn't go over SMS, I am a believer that SMS is not a good second factor method because
yes.
The SMS itself can be intercepted by the adversary. And so you're not actually protecting yourself against the type of adversary we're talking about today. It's imperative today for you to have second factor, number one, but also use second factor that is a true second factor token that is, hardware and offline.
Okay, Rob Simmons, Director of Research Innovation at Threat Connect. Thank you so much for coming on and speaking with us at the Security Ledger.
Thank you. It's been great speaking with you.